Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello, this is Lewis Herbert, and I'm in the studio with Tom Holbrook, a leading urban designer, and David Cleveley, and he is a serial entrepreneur. And I've been leading a series of programs about Cambridge called Cambridge Challenges. And one of our continuing themes is not just the planning system and how that works for residents and the much-paced development that the city engages in, but where is it going? And we are focusing today on Cambridge in 2040. A couple of months ago, we talked to our two leaders, Mike Davey for the city and Bridget Smith, who leads at South Cambridgeshire District Council. And we were really looking at what their preferences are and what they think the community needs looking ahead to 2040. And we were also building in, because there were announcements just before Christmas, what the Michael Gove initiative is, which also focuses on that. So here in the studio today, we're kind of continuing that theme, but we're well informed by two people who've been here a long time. They've invested in this city in the sense of their thought and time, and in many other ways, and they've got strong opinions about exactly what is the future of the city. First of all, we're going to reflect on where the city was when they arrived. So Tom, just by way of brief introduction, you've got a long history of contributions. You lead an architect and design practice, Fifth Studio, which is we're proud to have in the city. You were a big innovator in thinking through what are the options for the area around the wastewater treatment plant well before the current initiative. You came up with some inspired thinking there, and then also were commissioned when the government was a fan of the Oxcam Arc, and they similarly came up with further ideas for sustainable and successful, and one would hope equal development. And you're also, because you're not busy enough, the urban design advisor to the Mayor of London. Tom, think back about when you came to Cambridge and the Cambridge that you enjoyed, and think forward to now, and just think, say, some of the themes that that are important to you about the city that is your city.
Yes, I think looking back to when I was growing up in the city in the early 80s, it was a much less prosperous space, I suppose, but it was a much more equitable place. For example, in the early 80s, it was possible to buy a house for three times the average salary in the city. And now that's 14 times the average Cambridge salary. So I think one of the things that's changed the most, although physically there are not too many signs of that in Cambridge, in the city centre, it's a much harder place to be. It's a much less equitable place to be. Many people are priced out of the city compared to that period which I remember first when I first came to Cambridge.
And we had in last month's programme quite an insight from someone who graduated in 22 and is now leading an organisation called Priced Out nationally, and Cambridge is on their list as one of those cities that really has a problem built around housing inequity. Inequality. David, just by way of introduction, thank you for coming. David Cleveley is our second guest today, and David has had a record of serial creation of successful technology companies, starting with Abcam in 1998, a mere 26 years ago, and has also been an active voice for the city. He helped create the Centre for Science and Policy, which is a hugely influential group, including because it bridges into the UK government and national policy. And David also both helped as vice chair of a major economic review for the whole county, which has produced what the Speer Report produced, a really important review about our and the wider economy, and continues to play a big role, including in Cambridge Ahead. David, when did you meet Cambridge?
I met Cambridge in 1976 as somebody who was arriving for work. I'd encountered Cambridge a little bit before that, and my wife and I had been walking up and down Riverside and decided that's where we, if we moved to Cambridge, that's where we'd buy a house. But of course, as Tom points out, it was a lot more affordable then. I joined a thing called the Long Range Studies Division, which was based down in Hills Road. And at that time, it was in a modern office block, one of the many that was going to arrive in Cambridge, but was pretty new and a pretty different kind of way of approaching things even then. And during the time that I've been here, I've been struck by a few things. One, first of all, I did my PhD here after I resigned from my job and did my PhD in Cambridge, and then went down to work in London. But because of the Siegel Quince Wicksteed report called The Cambridge Phenomenon, I decided this was the place to be. And
it certainly told a good story for the city, yeah. I mean, yeah. So much in that early Science Park ventures, so many combinations between really world-leading research and the commercial value of that, the jobs value.
Yeah, huge. It was pretty small at the time, certainly compared to somewhere like Silicon Valley, and nothing like the what we've got at the moment. But as a sociologist once said in the 1920s, if enough people believe something to be true, it will be true in its consequences. And I think that the Siegel Quince Wicksteed report, that Cambridge phenomenon labelling, made a huge difference to the city. It gave people confidence that there were things happening here and unlocked an awful lot of momentum that was already building.
So that's a really interesting thread, because there's something about the Cambridge phenomenon which other people come and try and find out about. There's a relaxed exchange. There's obviously a lot of different entrepreneurs. There's a lot of startups, but there's kind of a camaraderie between a lot of the people in the city.
Yeah, that turning point where the camaraderie got built, I can probably date to about 97. And it was the point at which I started to encounter people like Herman Hauser and Andy Hopper and others involved in Arm and all those other things. And Alec Brose became Vice Chancellor of the University of Cambridge. Alec is, I think, an unsung hero in a lot of these things. He had a far-sighted vision about where Cambridge University was going to go, but he also had a vision about where the whole of the area was going to go and the place it would take in the UK. And as a result of that, we put together a thing called Cambridge Network, which many people have heard of. And we also did a number of other things in parallel with a chap called Martial Echenique, who was doing a thing.
Cambridge
exercise.
2030.
Well, there was Cambridge Futures, yeah. Which we may get onto as an excellent example of how to get democratic involvement in things. But in parallel, I began to develop some stuff, which we published a report called Cambridge 2020, which of course is now
at least
3 years in the past, if not four. And I began to get seriously interested in how to put that together. And the moment where I thought things had changed was after we formed Cambridge Network and started the collaboration. The kind of competition and infighting, say, between Sinclair and with the Acorn computers and that kind of stuff, the Chris Curry in the Baron of Beef, the famous punch-up.
So Acorn, Sinclair.
Yeah, that's right.
Going their separate ways with different innovation.
Yeah, and you know, forget it, right? This is a small city, and actually you get most economic progress by collaborating. And so that's what Cambridge Network was about. And I remember talking to somebody, an eminent person who'd helped found a CAD company, standing in a party to which I'd been invited, to a garden party, by a rival consultancy, because I'd set up my own consultancy at that point, and we were growing quite fast, and we were seen as rivals. And I'd been invited, and he said, this would never have happened before. And that's the point. The culture was always there, because in the collegiate system in Cambridge, you have an emphasis on collaboration. I know academics, fight tooth and nail to get their names on papers and do things, but there's a collegiate way of thinking about things, and that came through with Cambridge Network, and I think it's part of the reason why Cambridge is particularly unique in the way that it's built on that kind of long-term way of thinking.
So a three-way combination, fundamental research, local innovation, including small building up on some really powerful potential wealth creators and some of the bigger companies like we see today. And is that so for the next period, how big is that engine? And is that why the government looks at Cambridge and says, you're special?
Well, I've been involved in these things for quite a long time. And I suppose sometime after about 2010, I began to get a little bit more concerned that if we continued on the path that we were going on, the economic activity and the activity that was going to be attracted to this area would outrun the infrastructure and the support and the planning systems and those things. And I probably first began to raise that when I helped found Cambridge Ahead, which was in 2012. In 2015, I produced a paper which made the headlines on the Cambridge Evening News predicting that Cambridge would be a city of 600,000 people. And by 2065, when I look at some of Michael Gove's numbers, they match mine almost exactly, which is fairly disturbing. I don't know where they get their numbers from. But mine were done over a weekend using a spreadsheet.
Okay. Well, they're from different sources. So here we are. I mean, in brief summary, Michael Gove, before Christmas, he trimmed it. It was previously about 250,000 homes. And he cut it to 150,000, which is still a lot, given that that's in addition to 50 to 70,000 homes that are in the draft emerging proposals for the next period. And half of that is already in the existing local plan. But he also changed the geography a bit, because previously the assumption was that you could almost see where this growth was if you stood on a high enough building in Cambridge. But now he's talking about Bury St Edmunds, Haverhill, Harlow, the line to Stevenage, and particularly quite a lot of expansion, providing the infrastructure and connections are there with things like East-West Rail, west out to St Neots, to Huntingdon, and even into Bedfordshire. Looking at that as a proposal, what, Tom, do you think is really important in there, and what are some of the gaps? Because as we discussed with the leaders, we've got some big, and you mentioned the challenge of housing. We've got a huge housing challenge, but there's also water, there's the environment, and there's actually, well, what is special about Cambridge? There's no point in chucking it the baby out.
Well, absolutely. And I think David's put his finger on it. You know, that success that around the Cambridge phenomena, the reason why people like David come here to set up and innovate isn't to do with the number of houses, although not enough houses obviously limits the capacity of the city to address success. I don't think it's unusual that either this government or a future Labour government perhaps has its eye on Cambridge, because at the moment in the UK there's not many stories of great economic success. So there's a productivity crisis, and Cambridge and Oxford are bucking that to some extent. They're some of the UK's most sort of successful, productive places. But to help that productivity, you can't just add housing. You have to start thinking about things that the city hasn't had since my childhood in the 80s. And that is down to the quality of the infrastructure. It is down to the quality of the spaces that the city shares rather than the private space of where people live. And that really hasn't had any investment for a generation. I think
So this is culture and its access also to what is a better countryside than sometimes we think. We've got quite an insular city in many ways, but you're saying that we still haven't added some of the special that we should have.
Well, that's right. I mean, we found that out in the pandemic when we were allowed out for our daily walk, that actually there wasn't a lot of space if everyone took that walk at the same time. The spaces through the commons and along the river were pretty packed out.
Beautiful spaces, but not enough for a city which has got to 140,000 people.
Absolutely. Our pavements are creaking, they're very narrow. And I think the thing about growth that's really interesting, and you know, I think Gove's plan does address to some extent is...
Except that we're not going to have the kind of Holland Park Avenue maisons and four-story buildings. We may have well-designed ones. So what do you see in that plan that should be setting the bar for the quality of environment and housing?
Well, I mean, I think we definitely need to invest much more in public transport. And it's something that as a country we're historically we've been very bad at.
Been bad because we're letting development occur and then catching up.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we're still catching up from an idea about the preservation of Cambridge at a city of 100,000, which was the planner William Holford's idea of preserving a city in Aspic, the quintessential English university city from the 1950s, with a green belt around it. And the trouble is that growth had to leapfrog that green belt, and now Cambridge has the biggest travel to work area pretty much in the UK, and people are having to travel in for over an hour to get into the city. We have these problems of congestion. People really don't have the choice about whether to drive or not. There are no real public transport alternatives to the private car, so we need to sort that out. And we do need the ability to think at that kind of wider scale of the travel to work area, or as you say, the water catchment area, these kind of much grander scales at which the city operates now with its hinterland around it.
David, you've taken a keen interest in transport, including working with the previous Combined Authority Mayor on an underground system. If we're looking at just the current growth and making sure that we get it right and we have transport, what would be some of your priorities and what's your looking forward thinking about how a successful city would look like?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge this growth. I think we have to come to terms with it. Human beings are very bad at understanding exponential growth. We saw that in the COVID crisis. Yeah. They didn't really understand how fast an infection actually spread. It doesn't go as a straight line. It goes as a curve that doesn't look as if it's doing very much, but is actually the same rate of growth and goes up through the ceiling pretty rapidly.
But wasn't it in the 2010 to 2020 period, Cambridge ahead, assisted by some very good data, were looking at growth rates as high as China in terms of both jobs creation and GVA creation?
Yeah, I mean, I was closely involved in that. I wrote the terms of reference for the report, the Cambridgeshire and Peterborough Independent Economic Review. As you say, I have vice-chaired it. The issue about that was to say, look, just do these projections. They're not forecasts, projections. This is, if we grow like this, what are the consequences? And the consequences, as far as the Speer report were concerned, was that during the mid-2030s, we were grind to a halt. We're beginning to have the conversations now in 2024 that we can vaguely see over the horizon this looming disaster. And the disaster is partly transport, as Thomas talked about. It's partly about the environment and the open spaces. It's about water that you mentioned. There's electricity. Their communications, other communications, broadband communications and mobile communications. Housing is very low down on that list. And the problem that I see is that unless we address the infrastructure gap that can only get bigger, there is no point in talking about additional houses because we haven't done what the Victorians would have done. Bazalgette in his hydraulics in his system,
or saving London from dying from lots of diseases,
or the planning of the London transport systems during the 19th century. Those things led the development. They didn't follow
the Metropolitan line. Lots of actual forward thinking investment.
Why did Hammersmith grow? It's because of the Metropolitan line. All of West London grew like that. We have lost the plot. This is not about housing. This is about infrastructure. We need to lead with infrastructure. And infrastructure comprises all of those things, including the things that make the quality of life for everybody, in health and education and transport and water, how we do a renewable future. Those things need to be sorted out before we can begin to think about housing.
Well, and that's very important, including because I think the realization from fairly unsupported initial proposals from the government about how many homes and what is this about, there was no real mention of infrastructure. There wasn't even any thought of the footprint. So when we're looking, and it has to be a reasonably robust debate with government as a community representing residents. Residents say, councils working as a team, they need to be asking for a lot of money because that infrastructure, the spread growth, which is what seems to be what the government's now talking about, can't happen without high quality rail, high quality infrastructure. Tom?
So Michael Gove established a development corporation. This is the idea that will, this is the kind of structure that he's proposed around the growth of the city. Now, successful development corporations need to be built around a mission. It's, you know, they're going to take significant monetary investment, but also time from government. So they need to create a very clear public good. Now, just creating lots of housing isn't necessarily on its own a public good.
Well, they're not going to achieve it unless they answer some of the challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think they need. I think we need to hear a much clearer mission statement around what are we trying to establish with Cambridge. What should Cambridge be in 2040 and 2050? Certainly, is it going to be a more equitable place? Is it going to be a greener place? What
are
those kind of...
got to address the whole climate change emergency, as well as the fact that we're kind of in the we're in the heart of that as a city with such a water shortage and such a stretch on other capacity.
Absolutely, it's a city that needs to live within its planetary boundaries, but this issue of quality of life that David mentions, I think, is also part of it, because people won't come here to start their innovative enterprise if it's not and doesn't maintain that issue of quality of life.
And we, as is rightly said, the nature of the Cambridge economy is it's competing with sort of Frankfurt, Boston, Silicon Valley, some of the other hot growth areas. David, I thought it was interesting there from Tom that there needs to be an evidence-based statement about exactly what's this about. What's your take on actually the route to both ensure that residents have got a say, but also there's a clarity about exactly how much public money needs to be at the beginning of this?
I said earlier on about Marshall Echenique and his consultation over Cambridge Futures as a model for how you do that consultation. And those listeners who may not know or remember it, he presented seven alternatives and there was a vote. You could go into the Guildhall, see the exhibition. There was an awful lot of publicity about it. And overall, the majority was in favour of expansion, but with certain conditions, which was pretty well the kind of thing we've been discussing. It's about making sure we have adequate infrastructure and that we improve, not just preserve or conserve, but improve our quality of life. And certainly for some of the more disadvantaged areas in Cambridge, I would desperately like to see their quality of life improve. I think the there's this point about public money, and I come at this from a rather different point of view.
But someone's going to have to fund far better rail. We've got several levels of transport. We've got a walking zone, a cycling zone, a bus zone, and then a bigger transport zone. But so you're coming at it from a different point of view.
I am, and the point of view I come at it is somebody who starts companies. Hopefully,
well, try and start a transport company, perhaps.
Well, the point about it is that an entrepreneur looks at something and doesn't look at what resources they have available. They look at what they want to achieve and then how do they go and get the resources they need to achieve what they want.
And how to start the journey.
Exactly. And when I first encountered the planning system and the way that local government interacted with national government, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, nobody would create such a dysfunctional system.
They're still tinkering with it, but it ain't going to change much.
Well, I don't think an entrepreneur
would actually start a planning system.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't start. Well, no. Hang on a second. There are a lot of reasons why you would think about the at the systems level.
Yeah.
How does the system operate? And one of the red flags, alarm bells that goes off, is the notion that you can spend money on one thing, but then the benefit of it accrues separately to somebody else. Now, if that's the case, there is no way that anybody can signal, I've made an investment on your behalf, this has become valuable for you, and I can get some payback for it.
Yeah.
Where is that mechanism in all of this? We've got these Section 106s, we've got these very peculiar rules and all these bits and pieces. What it does is it leads us into talking about somehow public money, as if the money is being spent and wasted on things for other people's, and we're not recognising how it benefits other people, nor are we capturing that value. That may be that you need a governance structure which is a corporation. Personally, I think corporation is a very short-term fix. It's adding to the complexity. We should be really thinking much longer term about how we revitalise town planning, for example, how we think about the system from the beginning. How is it our Victorian forebears were able to justify the kind of level of investment that would cause most political people to faint at the sight?
Well, faint at the moment because we're nearly broke as a country in terms of the...
But we're broke as a country because we haven't taken this view.
Yeah.
We're broke as a country because what we have done is underinvested. We have thought that it's most important to try and keep some kind of notion of balanced budget, when actually the most important thing, and if you look at the United States, for example, is Biden pursuing that kind of policy? No, he isn't. What the United States has always done is invested huge amounts of money in this stuff and sees enormous economic growth.
Yeah.
We have made a category error.
Cambridge 105 Radio. So this is Cambridge 105 Radio and I'm in the studio with Tom Holbrook, a leading urban designer, and I'm also in the studio with David Cleveley, and he is a serial entrepreneur, but someone who's got some great thinking about the future of our city. So let's dig into that, because if you look at, say, how London grew, it was a strange Victorian act for often a laissez-faire economy, but it was a massive public sector transport investment. And in equity, as well as addressing some of the other challenges, what the Gove proposals, or what a distributed look at satellite communities linked to Cambridge, and in a way preserving the quality of Cambridge, but obviously we'll come back to the issue of affordable housing and equity, is a lot of that investment's got to be up front. So unless you've got some tools like land value capture, or some of the discussions that were had with Treasury about recognising the future additional economic wealth generation and how much they would make out of that. How, David, just following that up, that theme, entrepreneurialism is a good thing. It can come out of public sector, social enterprises, and it's about that sort of having a recognition about how good can come out. How can we upfront invest and make sure that overall, not necessarily full Treasury orthodoxy, but a wise government would see that it's got to be good. It's the foundations have got to be put in first.
Well, I think the first step is the recognition that investment generates not only a straightforward return that you can capture using the Treasury Green Book, which is the rules for how you do the assessments on projects like this. But as the Victorians realised, they were creating something in addition to that, and growth beyond anything that they could actually see. You see this in the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. They want to do things that appear slightly crazy. The venture capitalists will back them. They can see some kind of growth. And some of those companies then grow way, way beyond anything anybody, even the entrepreneurs themselves.
Isn't part of it that an entrepreneur or what we see now, we can't see what's really 2040 is going to be like. It's almost like some of it is round a corner and... But we kind of know some of what we need to do, which we've focused here on transport investment.
That's right. And that's going back to some of the things I've said previously. The attempts that I've made to project into the future. I mean, I cut my teeth at the Long Range Studies Division in Cambridge. We were looking ahead 20 or 30 years. A lot of what I've done in business and helping in government has been to say, right, let's jump way into the future. Yeah. And now let's look back. What is it that we wish we had been doing in 2024 that has enabled us to get where we are now? That kind of thinking I would like to see rather more widespread than it is, because I think what we have is government in all its forms, local and national, starved of resources and just living hand to mouth day to day instead of thinking about that longer term future. That's why I helped form Cambridge Ahead. Yeah. And that's why I did the Spear Review. That's why I've been doing all these things. Let's lift our eyes from the, you know, just what's in front of us.
And both of you, I'm reading and feeding back from what I'm hearing, believe that a sort of vision piece could be put together about exactly what could happen in the next 10 or 20 years, and then there can be spread out different routes to it or different options, and some of that openness is what the residents want. I mean, people living in the city, they've got children growing up, we've got a big investment in education. How can we compose or bring all of that thread into something that can actually be read by local people and they can make some choices about? Tom, you've done some very bold versions of this. How can we combine all of that thinking and options in a way that people feel that they're part of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that we used to be quite good at this as a country, and I think at the moment we're in a sort of mode of muddling through. We've been muddling through for as long as I can remember.
Muddling through on a downward slope.
Well, quite. But actually, with a city like Cambridge, it's great to have an ambitious idea of where you want to get to. And to be ambitious
and
about...
And to identify some of the gaps that you talked about.
Absolutely. And to be ambitious in terms of the kind of public landscapes we could create to enable growth so that it's not all about chipping away. I think people in the city feel that they've given up a lot, that there's been a sort of sense of loss, you know, as sprawl happens, as cars fill up our streets, as our pavements sort of get more and more cracked and smaller.
And as the council doesn't get enough money to deal with the extra population.
And devolution is part of that, and I think affordable housing is a really important part of that. So we have to get back to planning. We've had no regional planning since 2010. As you've alluded to, the kind of local authority arrangement is incredibly fragmented and complex, very hard to get one's head around as a citizen. And I think we do need devolution. We do need a sort of real...
Proper devolution,
an arrangement with Treasury, who are you know, too jealous about the reins of economic power. So, you know, we've got a city with lots of people with ideas. I think we need to get better at articulating those ideas into a vision that really is welded together, that makes sense as a totality, which is greater than the sum of the parts, and then work out how we get to that. You know, having articulated a kind of, as I say, a sort of mission, a public good, if you like.
And your input to add to that, David?
Well, I completely agree. I mean, the old saying, a society grows great where people plant trees whose shade they will never sit under. I like to think about it as we will never cycle under.
We've planted a lot of good trees up Milton Road, and I probably won't be around to see the full benefit. So,
but that's what makes a great society, isn't it? That's what makes a proper community, and we need to get back to that longer-term thinking. That's the way in which we need to approach this. And
but Cambridge could say that to Treasury. I mean, we've been in and out on Treasury several times. We got some money for transport, and that included a bureaucracy. We've then got some money for the combined authority. That's a new bureaucracy. But each time, that was one of the few times when Cambridge had a municipal dialogue with the real power base in London.
Yeah, and the thing we need to move away from is being the other element of what Tom said, was moving away from being a client, right? Let's have proper devolution.
Let's pitchforks and
No.
But how do we persuade them?
It's peer to peer. You see, the point is, as Tom points out, there's a lot of talent in Cambridge, and the surrounding region. We've got some great ideas. We need to be able to do this, but not as supplicants. Again, your point about earlier about public money, which made me kind of jump back. I don't like the idea because it implies that somehow we're clients. We are an engine of economic growth, and we should have the capabilities to be able to do the best things on the ground. One of the things that everybody knows, that when you get somebody coming up from London, they have really no idea about how Cambridge works in all its fine and glorious detail.
Which is why they've got Peter Freeman in a role which he probably doesn't have the resources enough to do.
Well, Peter Freeman is doing a pretty good job, okay? He understands an awful lot of this stuff. He's been involved in a number of things. And I wouldn't want to do what he's doing, but nevertheless,
it's an ongoing job.
But even Peter Freeman and the people who are helping him haven't got the detailed understanding of what is happening in this region. Yeah. The people who have it are people like Tom.
Yeah, well, and you. So I say public money because National Choices with such a little pot of money that's in the Treasury at the moment are really hard, and the case has to be made for actually pulling resources. I mean, we don't get East West Rail without public money, and some of the other transport transformation or other additions that we need to make our larger community lovable are not free. Some of it may not be public money, but I think it's about the economic driver, which says there's so much going to happen that this is the way to make it successful. What's your take there, Tom?
Well, it's a statement of intent, I suppose. The economist Mariana Mazzucato talks about missions and points out the Apollo mission, you know, the Apollo space mission in the 1960s was built around some very, very complex statements about, you know, getting to the moon. And to do that, lots of things had to happen. And there had to be investment from government, but there also had to be massive investment from innovators, manufacturers, all parts of industry to get to that. And yes,
well, came up with new materials. We had all sorts of new technology,
absolutely,
which was driven ahead,
which we're still using. As a kind of consequence of some of that thinking, you get smartphones and, you know, all sorts of things that we now are part of our everyday lives. And I think you could do something spatially that was very similar to that, spatially and economically.
Yeah, I think the spatial point here is really important. As we referred to earlier in this conversation, the notion of where the growth was going to take place has become slightly fluid. It was originally going to be somehow concentrated around Cambridge and is now being spread out. I, as a first point to plan for infrastructure, where I truly believe we have a an infrastructure gap, which if we don't start to address before we deal with houses, we will never get anywhere. But in order to understand that infrastructure gap exists within different pockets in different parts of the region. We need to understand what our spatial development plan is going to be. Mm. And then we need to be bold, right? Mm. As bold as the Victorians. In terms of transport or the other forms of infrastructure, electricity, water, plan for that future. And whilst I would not subscribe to this idea of unrestricted growth, I think it's a very bad idea.
Well, the opportunity is there to shape successful
growth. The opportunity
growth.
Is there to shape that growth so we can improve quality of life. That's the strategic vision that we should subscribe to.
Yeah, and why do people come to work and invent and invest in Cambridge? It's because it's a special place. And in addition to providing for the whole range of housing and in part, a distributed model is more likely to lead to everybody getting a good home than trying to concentrate it here. I think you said to me an earlier time, success would be if house prices don't rise in Cambridge.
Yes, I completely agree. I mean, if you imagine that you could somehow build another centre that was 10 minutes away by some kind of rapid transit system, and that could be 20 kilometres, 30 kilometres away from the centre of Cambridge easily. What effect would that have on house pricing in Cambridge? It's bound to prevent them from rising even further. I mean, whether they fell or not is another matter, but at least we could keep this stuff under control whilst then wages would rise and we would start to get a better ratio than 14 to 1.
And we would also need, if there was another community, or some of the other communities that might grow out of the existing towns, they would need to have quality of culture and environment. They would need to have that social investment. But also, we may be in a position, including because of the economic benefits of Cambridge, to get added benefit within 10 miles of here.
I think that's right, and it goes back to this idea about, you know, what is the geography when we talk about Cambridge and growth in Cambridge? Where do we go to? I mean, an example of a really good development corporation that I've been working with for, well, coming up to 20 years, was built around the Olympic Games on the Lee Valley. And
yeah, I did a trip out. I'm looking at a homeless project in Barking, and I'm seeing some of the Manhattan skyline as I'm on the local C2C railway.
Absolutely. I mean, that development corporation was set up, of course, to deliver the games, but that was a detail or a kind of important bit of a timetable that had a much bigger intent. And that was to bring, you know, the five poorest boroughs in London up to what was called convergence. So to bring those, the expectations of life, expectancy of health outcomes, of prosperity, up to the average of the rest of London. And that project is still going. But I think
they, on the metrics, Newham has been a big beneficiary.
A big beneficiary and hopefully
people,
will
people of
continue
all incomes,
to be.
All ethnicity, the whole range.
Absolutely. But the interesting thing about that development corporation was that it was centred on the Lee Valley. So that the Lee Valley has been a boundary, a political boundary for centuries. Actually, it was the boundary between Saxon and Danelaw a couple of millennia ago.
Now we're going back.
But Cambridge does need to... I think the advantage of a development corporation is that it could have a different geography from the political boundaries that exist. And that's really necessary because we need to think about that travel to work area. We need to think about, you know, a city of perhaps 100 kilometres across in terms of its where do people come from? You know, we need to think about from Haverhill across to Sandy and Bedfordshire. We need to think about from Stansted up to Peterborough and look for those spaces which probably exist at the boundaries between things on the county line. or between different administrations, because we need space. We need space to think about things like decarbonisation, about flooding, about gathering water, about finding new landscapes, reforestation. All these things will take space, as well as space for transport and housing and other things that we used to be good at in the city, like culture. So, you know, new places for producing culture,
for music,
you know,
for art,
putting things on, for actually building things, making things, that sort of thing that has been squeezed out by very high rents.
And some of the learning that you've invested in, David, where you're recognising that technology is creative and it draws in younger people, and there's a lot to celebrate.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the you look at, say, for example, even the evolution of Silicon Valley. You may think about it as technology and silicon chips and stuff, but the hippie movement played an enormous role. Rethinking and challenging anything. You've only got to look at a small company called Apple, which came out of exactly that tradition. We underestimate that kind of contribution at our peril.
Yeah, it's unleashing. It's human creativity, and orthodoxy is a dominant force. So just as our last theme for what's been an interesting and productive discussion, you've rightly said, Tom, there has to be a sort of mechanism, a means of bringing together. We're now talking about a bigger geography, and that in itself draws in the complexity of getting alignment far better. Let's just leave the words development corporation there, but because it could have whatever name it likes. But government believes in that as a mechanism, and to some extent, national politicians just make it so that it's nationally controlled. How can we produce, in addition to the vision we talked about and that engagement, where are we going? Ensuring that people are on the same track, or that some changes have been made because there's been an engagement with companies, but particularly with residents. What are some of the outputs or some of the freedoms that devolution should give that? Because, if you look at the benefit of the Olympics and just, or the, as you said, the what came out of what seemed to be a little bit spurious going out to the moon, just some of the threads that would be in there, and how would the local community feel that they're not going to be left behind by it?
I think we have to get, we have to be quite concrete about this. We have to be spatial. I think there's too much conversation at the moment about housing numbers and spreadsheets and economic, you know, it's very numerical at the moment. And that's because that's the way that Whitehall thinks about things. But what we're talking about is a very strong place, and it's a place that people love. So I think that we could start as a kind of mark of intent. We could start doing things, and we could see what works.
So there would be an organisation, and some of its early start would actually be to show that good things are going to happen.
Good things can happen, and people like good things, and actually take Cambridge's citizens with us. I think there's huge risks of creating division, and we've started to see some of that, sadly, in the city, with the congestion charge conversation and other things that actually...
We've kind of ducked the issue for a while, as we keep ducking some of the transport challenges.
Yes, exactly. I do think we can't just legislate against people. We need to show people that they've got skin in the game, and
so we've got
early
wins, but also we're catching up on some of the decisions we've not taken. David, on this kind of, this is an amorphous but theoretical organisation, and ideally it would have greater freedom than government has allowed areas. Aren't we just making the case that actually we can do this, we can achieve the kind of objective and the role of Cambridge in a very successful recovered British economy? What would be in the zone, in the orbit of that organisation that for you could be changed and achieve this, but could also make it that Treasury allows us to do it different?
Well, we need to think about governance structures, local political structures, how you get democratic input.
Well, I think you've got to
this.
Have some element that such an organisation that is able to do things differently, it has to win support, but it would actually need to take some of the freedoms to just get actually on with the job.
Well, if I were being idealistic about this,
you mentioned the hippies and back in Silicon Valley.
I mean, I would like to see some way in which the existing political structures could all work together through some kind of forum, and I would like to see where that forum had a strong democratic input. This isn't about appointing just a few people to a board or having people who've been elected by people who've been elected who then elect people to sit on boards.
No, we've got to have
simplification, simplification, so much more direct contact with people. You know, whether it's a people's assembly or whatever else it is, I think societies also work well when people buy into what is needed.
America,
and Marcial Echenique showed that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and America uses town hall meetings and that. But it's, I think, is there anything else that we should say to government? We need these powers or these freedoms, because effectively we've got a lot of determination, not just the brains of Cambridge, but the skills of Cambridge and the inclusion of Cambridge. Anything else that we can say to government, let us get on with this? We do buy into quite a lot of what we need to answer about the future.
Well, I think we need to paint that picture of Cambridge in 2060, 2070, and to show government that we are not perfectly, but roughly aligned on that, and that we have some ideas about how the stages we need to take. If you demonstrate to somebody you've got vision, and going back to being an entrepreneur again, pitching, you know, for some investment, you know, what convinces people to invest? You have a clear vision, you understand what you're going to do, you've got a business plan, you know where you're going, you know there are going to be twists and turns along the way, everybody knows about that, but you know what you're trying to aim for. We need to look up from just in front of our feet to the horizon and think longer term.
And it'll be a bold future. So I've had Tom Holbrook in the studio and David Cleveley. The challenge of the future, certainly the discussion we've had, is to actually shape what exactly the vision is and engage people, have a much more open picture about exactly what 2060 might look like. There will be some options, but there's definitely a power relationship that it has to be better done locally rather than decided and then told to us. So I hope you've enjoyed the last hour. We've aimed to dig into the issues. It is certainly not addressed in the simple statements that Cambridge needs 150,000 more homes. It needs the freedom, and it needs perhaps, not maybe the independent Republic of Cambridge, but it does need to have quite a lot of local ability to achieve things and overcome some of its own internal systems and the planning system. So thank you for contributing, the two of you. I hope you like the listening. I hope the listeners have gained from this hour. It's certainly been an interesting discussion.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thanks.